I call it the crow's nest. You know, being up there, we were
the radar
looking. I was on the lookout as far as the battle station is concerned, and we see those kamikazes come right at us, and they'd see that we weren't a carrier, and they'd flip over that way, and I don't think we knocked down more than one or two.
Yeah.
But they would come through, and we could just see the shells. They would have tracers, the lighted ones that would show, and they dadgum bullets would be going all around that dadgum kamikaze, and keep coming in until somebody finally get to it.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 26B, which is the conclusion of our two-part interview series with Mr. Bill Lozano, United States Navy, USS Washington, just an incredible man with an amazing story. Mr. Lozano, while he was on the USS Washington, he was a radar man. So he literally, his place of duty on the ship was in the crow's nest, which was basically the very top of the ship. So he had a very unique perspective on the war in the South Pacific as they jumped from island to island and they protected these various carrier fleets. Mr. Lozano was always the first person, first on radar and then visually, to see these kamikazes coming in, see the Japanese trying to attack the aircraft carriers, and just a very unique perspective on the war. And in part one, if you haven't listened to it, definitely go back and do so. But in part one of the series, episode 26A, Mr. Lozano talked about literally watching the men, the Marines on Iwo Jima, just trying to move through the island, just how brutal it was. And so, very unique perspective. It's not very often in this day and age, with the age of our World War II veterans, to, you know, most of the officers have passed. So the majority of the guys that are still alive were the youngest of the young during World War II. You know, an 18-year-old during World War II is going to be 95 or 96 years old now. So very rarely do we find the perspective of more of the strategic side of many of these battles, because usually the younger soldiers are the ones that were, or seamen or airmen or whatever, Marines, they were the ones that were on the front lines. So they didn't always know exactly where they were at. They didn't understand what they were doing or what was happening around them. They just understood the job that was in front of them. And so when you talk to somebody, or we talk to somebody like Mr. Lozano, who had that high level perspective of what was going on basically in the entire South Pacific, it's really an amazing perspective and just amazing to talk to. So this part two, episode 26B, will focus. We're going to kind of take a step back. We went in reverse a little bit in the sequence. So we're going to go back, talk a little bit about his childhood, growing up, what he did after the military, and sort of just take a step back and understand the rest of Mr. Lozano's life. And he has some very valuable lessons learned, I think, that are just great to pass on to younger folks these days, and really anybody. And there's so much wisdom to be gained from these incredible veterans. It's just amazing. I wanted, before we turn it over to Mr. Lozano, I wanted to say just a few words about what's been happening in Afghanistan. I mentioned it a little bit on the last episode, and since then, there's been a lot of people that have written in and heard from a lot of people regarding the tragedy that's unfolding there. And I just want to, again, reinforce for all of the veterans that were either involved in Afghanistan, served during this post 9/11 time frame, to all the Vietnam veterans who were basically seeing history repeat itself in terms of what the Vietnam veterans saw play out, you know, many years ago. Just want to say thank you to all of you. Thank you for serving. Thank you for sacrificing so much. And thank you for keeping us all safe. You know, regardless of what politically, you know, happens, or regardless of how the politicians try to spin things, the fact of the matter is, since you, the incredible veterans, entered Afghanistan, you've been able to keep us safe here at home. And so all of your service, all of your sacrifice, it meant a tremendous amount to all of us. It kept us safe. And, you know, now it's just, don't listen to the politicians. If you want to talk to somebody, reach out to other veterans, reach out to the Vietnam veterans, which have just been amazing, you know, in terms of paying it forward and reaching out to these younger veterans and talking to them. And, you know, it's a helpless feeling, because we're all watching this stuff on TV and we're all, you know, wondering, what can we do to help? What can we do to help? Best thing we can all do to help is reach out to somebody we know, let them know we're here for them, reach out to them, ask them if they're okay, talk to them, and give them an outlet. Because, you know, I'm not a doctor, I really don't know much about anything, but when it comes to PTSD and all of those very difficult things, you know, the number one sort of catalyst from my judgment, or from my point of view, the number one catalyst that really makes all these things spiral downhill is being alone. And when somebody is alone and your brain already is struggling with the PTSD and all that, it starts to kind of, you know, think things and warp itself and believe things that may not necessarily be true. And so that's why, to me, the number one way to combat all those things is to reach out and find those people that are alone and reach out to them and do what we all can to help. So that would be my advice, again, based on, you know, all the emails and feedback and conversations we've had about Afghanistan. Politically, forget about it. Doesn't matter. Politicians are always going to cause problems. Doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat. They don't know what they're doing. They can't navigate out of from here to the, you know, the other side of their house, right? Or the other side of their office. I mean, they're not wired such to understand military strategy. And so wasting our energy blaming these people who really have zero military value or understanding just isn't productive, in my opinion. So with that said, let's focus on the positive energy. Let's focus on reaching out to veterans. Let's focus on thanking them. If you see a veteran walking through the airport or walking through the mall or whatever, just say thank you. It's a big deal to them, and it gives them a sense of worth. And again, when you have PTSD and all these things manifesting themselves, and then you turn on TV and you know see the politicians try to spin this whole Afghanistan thing a certain way, just saying thank you probably goes farther than anything else that we could do. So that's what we can do to give back. That's what we can do to convey positive energy. And then volunteer with organizations like we have Wish for Our Heroes, which is a charity that helps military families. You know, there's so many other great charities out there. Volunteer, help people, give back, focus on positive energy. That's how we get through these difficult times. So I want to say thank you to all of those who sacrificed so much to get us to this point as a nation. And let's all do our part to help them and support them moving forward, okay? That's all I have to say there. Want to thank all of you for listening. Thank you for listening to Mr. Lozano's story. Simply an amazing man. I wish you could all meet him in person. He looks about 30 years younger than he actually is. He still exercises every day, goes to the gym, walks in the park, and he's just an amazing man. So without further ado, here's Mr. Lozano.
Did the submarines, Japanese submarines, bother you, or did they avoid the battleships?
We never had any, and that's one of the reasons we had the destroyers.
Right, right.
Because the destroyers had the sonar.
Right.
And
so the destroyers would keep them away or engage them if they got too close. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were never bothered by the submarines over there.
That's amazing. It's just amazing to think all of the different engagements that you were in and part of.
It didn't seem like much, really. Well, all of that, I compare it to my friend JJ being a foxhole.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't visualize, you know, being in a foxhole like that and yeah. people shooting at you and stuff. We have these planes that are shooting and stuff, but I mean, I was in a good position because we had this dadgum metal that was, you know, that thick around, and if they
right.
came close, all we had to do was just duck down, and they couldn't get to us and stuff. So, but those are the two things. I mean, you know, the kamikazes on one hand and Iwo Jima on the other hand. I mean, because in Iwo, we saw the people going in.
Right. You saw it with your...
It's like D-Day, and be out there watching the people going in. We saw them doing that. Where in Saipan and Tinian and Okinawa, we were bombing first, and then they were going in. But in Iwo, we were bombing as they were going in.
Yeah. That Iwo Jima was perhaps the most difficult military operation, you know, we've ever attempted. And the island was so small, nobody on the island was safe. You know, you guys would bomb them, the Japs would hide. You know, they'd go under caves.
Yeah, they were in that rock.
Yeah, they'd go into the rock.
The only thing that got them out of there was the damn flamethrowers.
Right, right. By the way, did you hear that Charles Coolidge passed away? He was one of the two living Medal of Honor recipients from World War II. And he passed away last week, and so now there's only one living Medal of Honor recipient. That's Woody Williams from Iwo Jima.
Well, we used to have one here in San Antonio, but I think he lived down in close to downtown San Antonio.
Yeah.
Downtown San Antonio. Can't think of his name right now, but I'm sure he's gone.
There's only one left from World War II, and that's Woody Williams.
Right?
That's it. And of course, his was awarded. He was a flamethrower, which is what made me, when you said flamethrower, I just thought of it, but he was a flamethrower on Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and just like you see that famous picture of raising the flag up there.
Oh, that's Mount Suribachi. That's...
Yeah, and like I said, you know, I can see Truman's problem. You know, I mean, if we're going to go invade Japan and lose, you know, millions of young people's lives, or use a bomb, I mean, that took a lot of courage.
So you... After the invasion of Okinawa, that's when you came back to the U.S. to prepare for the...
Yeah, we went, like I say, in Okinawa, we went up chasing Japan, Japanese Navy. We went over close to the Philippines.
That's right.
We never landed. We never landed on any place. The only place we ever landed was Hawaii and Ulithi, where we got off and go to Mog Mog with our two beers.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we were on a nice cruise.
And so you returned it to the U.S. to refit for the invasion in the summer, sometime in the summer of 1945.
Yeah, it was probably June because, like I said, that's when that picture was taken.
Yeah.
When I was home on leave. And I was actually going back to my ship, and I had it over. Everything was by train. I mean, planes weren't back there then. And so we got off at Denver, and that's when we heard that the bomb had been dropped and Japan had been surrendered, and everybody was trying to get all the service people drunk.
How'd you feel at that point when you heard that?
I don't know. You know, I just don't remember. You know, it's just something, you just don't know how you feel.
Yeah.
I mean, you just feel happy that you're not going back.
Yeah.
And then we went into another phase, though, that our ship did, because once I got back to the ship after the bomb, mm-hmm. what we did is we came back through the Panama Canal, mm-hmm. and we went up to Philadelphia. From Philadelphia, we went to Southampton, England, and got a load of army people. And everywhere they could sit on the ship, they put them there. We started halfway decommissioned as far as the crew was concerned. I mean, we got rid of everybody that wanted to get off. I mean, all the older people wanted to get off so they could get discharged. And they kept the younger people on because, I mean, we were in 6 months after the war, almost a year after the war was over, we were still in. But we made at least two trips, and I can remember, because we went from Philadelphia to Southampton and picked up a crew. We came back to New York, mm-hmm. and docked in New York and stayed there for a week or so. And then we made another trip, and we came back to Boston, Massachusetts. And that's when they decommissioned the ship in Boston.
Interesting.
And we all got off the ship in Boston. And then it was what they call a receiving station, where you just go there and you have nothing to do. Mm. I mean, they give you a job to go around picking up cigarette butts and stuff like that and stuff. But there was some yeomen that were selling leaves. So, I mean, you could buy a leaf for $1 a day. And so I was tired of that place there. So I said, well, I had a few bucks, and so I got a 20-day leave to come home. And he said, where do you want to report in? I said, well, what's the closest place around? Is it Carpus or Dallas Naval Administration? And so let's go up to Dallas. I haven't been up there. So I did my leave. Mm-hmm. I got off. Had my sea bag all packed and landed up in Dallas. And the officer of the day said, don't unload your sea bag. Says, here's your orders. And I had orders to go to San Diego to a receiving station. So I went actually from a receiving station in Boston by way of a small leave and went over to San Diego.
Back to the other coast.
And they had these tents with wooden floors.
Right.
And I think there was about anywhere from 8 to 10 people sleeping in those things. And during the day, we were picking cigarettes or cleaning things and stuff like that. Just waiting. And the problem was, you know, I was one of the youngest ones. And the older ones were getting off.
Right.
And so they couldn't just discharge everybody at one time. They were using the process of age plus time in service.
Right.
And those were the people that were getting off first. And I was the youngest and the least amount of service. Because I don't like to say I was in from say, January the 1st to the end of April 1946.
Yep.
So I was out in California probably about 3 or 4 months at that damn receiving station, and they finally gave us the orders, and we ended up coming back to a camp right outside of Houston called Camp Wallace.
Okay.
That's where we got discharged there, and that's when they tried to get everybody to join the Naval Reserve, and I had enough, and I wasn't about to join it. But with all this stuff behind me, it was very rewarding, because what I got out of it when I got here, I was able to use the GI Bill of Rights.
Right.
And I got out in April, in 1st of June, I was out here at St. Mary's University.
That's wonderful.
Told them I wanted to go to law school, and they said, well, you got to do this, and this before you go, and then you go to law school. And so went there and I went to school. I started in June, mm-hmm. and I went all the way through June, and then all the way through long semester, and then all the way through June again. And I took double courses to get through because everybody wanted to get out. And then I went to law school, and like I said.
And the military allowed you to do that with the GI Bill.
Yeah, I mean, they gave, I mean, I got more than I gave them. They sure. gave me a livelihood which took care of me my whole life.
Yeah.
And I've never been bitter about serving in the Navy.
I mean, sure.
I mean, I think that's, first of all, it made me grow up from a kid to a man.
Sure.
I mean, that's the first thing. And then giving me the tools to make a living for the rest of my life. So I just appreciate that.
And after you went to law school, you stayed here, and you've been here in San Antonio your whole life.
Yes. When I graduated from law school, the Air Force JAG came along and said, we need lawyers in our Judge Advocate General.
Sure.
We'll give you a First Lieutenant's Commission.
Sure.
And I guess of our graduating class, maybe six of the people took that. Mm-hmm. And two of them, I know, came back and retired as full colonels. But my problem was that I had parents living here. Mm-hmm. My brother had gone to West Point, mm-hmm. and he missed World War II, but he got captured in Korea and was a POW there for almost 3 years. But he was in the Army and retired as a full colonel. And my sister married one of the local pilots here they were never here. In other words, my brother was away, my sister was away, my parents were here, and I knew somebody had to take care of them. Mm-hmm. And so when they asked me whether I wanted to do that, I said no.
Yeah.
But I often wondered if I'd have done that, how my life would have been. I really don't know.
I think you served enough time. You did your service to the country, and you know that's more than enough. You know,
it's no. I'm happy with my life.
If you graduate, what you ended up practicing, or where you ended up practicing after law school?
Well, I had an uncle who was a lawyer, and he was here. He's a sole practitioner. But he helped me get started.
I see.
But I never worked for him as such. I mean, he was a politician. In fact, he's one of our city councilmen in the good government league. And he also was instrumental in getting the West Side State Bank started. But he was not one to say, come here and you can do this case, you can do that for me and stuff. Because he was, I think he needed all the money that was coming in, because he was handling divorces and small cases like that and stuff. And so, and my aunt was his secretary. And so I guess about the first 6 months, I was in an office on the same floor and, had my telephone in his office so that my aunt could answer it for me and buzz me and stuff. And so I was sitting in an office starving to death. But and it would get me, because they had a legal paper and they'd come out the commercial recorder that shows all the lawsuits filed and stuff like that. And we'd read through it and I'd look at it, and I see this friend of mine was getting a divorce, and so he went to see this lawyer over here. And it sort of I got a little, you know, downhearted for a while, but then it slowly picked up. One time, lawyer with a large firm came to me and said, Bill said, I've got this fellow that has a problem with an automobile ticket at corporation court. And so he said, well, you take care of it for me and stuff? And says, just charge it what you want and stuff. I said, okay. And so I went over. Evidently, I don't remember the outcome or whatever happened, but he was really a ne'er-do-well. Really, well, he painted these water tanks in these small towns and stuff like that, the insides, the outsides and stuff. But he had a son who was riding his bicycle and somebody come along and just knocked the hell out of him. And so he, instead of going back to that other lawyer, he came to see me. Mm-hmm. And so I was handling, getting ready to file suit, and the insurance adjuster came in and says, you know, Bill said, we know we're wrong, says this guy's got $10,000 of liability, and so this is what we'll pay you, because we can't pay you any more. And I said, well, fine. And so I ended up getting a $3,000 fee from this fellow, where they, by originally coming out of a $25 appearance in corporation court, and that was my first good start. And he happened to be so satisfied and so happy that I got a number of referrals from him, because his friends were always getting in trouble and stuff. And then, so, you know, that was one of the first cases that gave me a little shove. And then after, a year after I graduated, the dean came and asked me if I wanted to teach at law school part-time.
Right.
And so I said, sure. I mean, I needed everything I could get.
Sure.
And so... 1 year out of law school, I was teaching a 3-hour course and getting paid $90. And the course that I was teaching was wills and estates. And I don't remember exactly when it was, but like I said, I graduated and got my license in 1950. But this was about 1965 or so, when I'd been teaching wills and estates for a long time and had given speeches at seminars and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there was a big case involving a person who lived here and in the Philippine Islands. And the case involved illegitimate children of a large estate. And and so what happened was that a lawyer in San Francisco had gotten to represent part of the estate.
Okay.
And he said he needed somebody to represent him here.
Texas.
And so he contacted the dean of the law school, and he said, well, the logical person would be my Wilson Estates teacher. And so he referred the case to me. And this case went on probably a year or so, but the long and the short of it was that we ended up, between both of us, we ended up getting a $40,000 fee.
Wow.
And so we split the fee, and they paid me the $40,000. And I put it in my trust account, and I wrote him a check for $20,000. And about 6 months later, after I'd filed my income tax, the income tax people wanted to come down and wanted to know what happened to that other $20,000. Mm-hmm. So I just opened up my checkbook, and I showed them. I said, here's where I put it in. This is where I set up 20 over there, and I kept 20, and I reported it. And so, and that was one, that was the largest fee that I ever made.
Wow.
And the good part about that, it was the best investment I ever made with it, because we were looking for a place up in Lake LBJ because a number of our friends were out there. And so Lola's cousin said this person across the street that had a lakefront property, there's a little cabin on it, wanted to sell it. $17,500. And I had
$20,000.
Yeah. So I just went up there and looked at it and said, oh, hell, sure. So wrote out an earnest money contract in longhand, ended up investing that $20,000. My family had the best time in the world with that. And when I finally sold it in 2005, I got a big chunk of money.
I'm sure you did.
Now. So, you know, what I'm saying is that everything, that I've had a good life, everything has fallen into place.
Cause and effect.
And I don't regret anything. I mean, I've had a lot of good friends along the way. My son said the best thing that ever happened to us when we joined Hope Lutheran Church.
Yeah.
Because we knew all the people there. I was president of the church congregation one or two times and got to know everybody and the preachers and stuff like that. And the kids got to know nice children there too. Sure. And so, you know, it just, everything seemed to go right.
And when did you meet Mrs. Lozano? When did you meet Lola?
I met her in probably 1953.
Okay.
I was practicing in the Frost National Bank building where their office was.
Yeah.
And they had a bowling league. And so I started bowling with the Frost Bank League.
Yeah.
And I mean, we bowled with Tom Frost and Joe Frost and all the people. We all knew everybody. But then there was another friend that worked at Kelly Field, mm-hmm. and that they wanted to get this bowling league started down at Herman Sons. But in order to do that, to bowl at Herman Sons, you had to be a member of Herman Sons. And so, and they weren't taking Mitchins.
Yeah.
There, anybody, they were trying to keep it. But at that time, they had about 20 or 30 people that were coming in, and I was one of them. And so I squeezed in and became a member of Herman Sons and on the bowling league, and that's where I met Lola. At the bowling league. So that was, because we got married in 1953, so it was probably 1952 or so that I met her there. And everything just went right, and she worked for me as my secretary for a while. I mean, she had been working at Kelly Field for somebody and had quit there was working for a Piper aircraft dealer at the airport. And so when we got married, and like I said, that's another story, because the owner of the Piper company there needed a contract drawn on a Sunday. And so I went out and drew a contract and said, what do you owe you? I said, nothing, you know. And he said, well, here, I'll give you a ride in the airplane. So I went up in this little airplane. I never was so glad to get back down in my life. You know, he was doing me a big favor, but I never would take that again. But we ended up like that, and we both wanted a family.
Yeah.
And we tried for a couple of years.
Yes.
And Rosie Reeves was, and I went to high school together in Jefferson, and he had adopted several children.
Yeah.
And his office was down hall from mine, and he knew we were trying to have kids and stuff, and he came to me one afternoon and said, Bill, says, I have a friend at this adoption agency. Mm-hmm. They've got a boy that's about 8 months old that they want to want to have somebody adopt that you're interested in. And so
it's wonderful.
I told Lola about it, and she said, oh, fine, let's go, let's do it.
It's wonderful.
And so we filed our applications and stuff like that, and at the time we were going to Grace Lutheran Church downtown, and so the pastor was on the, happened to be on the board of that adoption agency, and so he vouched for us and stuff like that. And because this little boy had been dropped off, and they didn't know
really
any background or anything, didn't know his parents or anything like that, and so they said fine, and so we went over, and he was at a foster home, and we visited there for a little bit, and of course we fell in love with him, and they we started to leave, and said, can we take him now? And he said no. So I said, but we want to, you know.
Yeah.
And they finally said, well, okay, because he was hanging on my
he didn't want
shoulder and pulling my necktie and stuff like that, and so we took him home, and like I said, we thank, you know, Brudgy. Hell, Brudgy came over and brought baby clothes for us and stuff like that, and other people bought a crib for us and stuff. Like everything was secondhand, but we were happy to get it and stuff like that. And hell, 3 months later, my wife was pregnant. And this was before the adoption was final. And so we were afraid that if they found out about that, that they wouldn't let us adopt. But so we didn't tell anybody. And we got connected with a doctor here, a Dr. William Brendel. And he was real... He was also connected with that agency, and so he was vouched for our death too, and so we finally adopted Tony, and then about 6 months later we had a girl, and then we had a second one, so we had two girls and a boy. And
that's
so
wonderful.
Like I said, everything worked out fine. I'm happy with everything except by myself now.
I know. Well, you both lived had a very long, long.
We did, marriage. And like I said, you know, we used to do things, and how we did it, I don't know. But like I said, for vacations, I finally associated with another attorney, G.J. Valdez, and he never took vacations, so he would. He and I weren't partners, we just were associates.
Worked together.
But he would cover for me when I was gone. So every year after I had the children, I'd set aside 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't take any cases in that time.
Yeah.
And if something come up, he would handle it and postpone it for me and things like that. And we had one of these 46-ounce cans of tomato juice, except we made it into a bank. And every time I came home, if I had 50 cents or $2, I just put it in there. And at the end of the year, we'd open it up to go on our vacation, and we'd have maybe $400 or $500. And we did things, little things like that, that just seemed to work for us. And the kids, we did a lot of camping vacations. And so we would rent these pop-up campers. And the kids, that's all they remember, all us, the good times we had and stuff.
That's amazing. That's the power of the simplicity of life, because now, you know, everybody spends all their time in these phones and video games, and people lose sight of each other, you know, and what you did was valuable time spent together with each other.
I think those vacations made us a family.
Right.
They brought us together, and we'd sleep in a little, small little place, Lil and I one side, and two girls up here, and we had a little cot in the middle, and we'd sleep in there. Sometimes it would be raining, couldn't get out. We'd be up in Yellowstone Park.
Oh, wonderful.
Or we'd camp up in in Arkansas or just most of the western parks we go to and stuff.
What a wonderful time spent together.
Yeah, and it just made the family stick together.
And you, so you and Mrs. Lozano were, from that point, I mean, how many years was that that you were?
We were married, would have been married 66 years.
66 years.
And she was originally from Fredericksburg. And she actually raised her younger brother because her father ran off and left them.
I see.
Her mother died when she was real young. Her older sister got married when she was 15. And her brother was adopted by an aunt and uncle of hers.
Yeah.
And so she and her younger brother were, she had to take care of him. And so, and then he finally got a job as a lineman for the telephone company and ended up dying in a car crash. And so we did, and we had a good relationship with her family. We'd go up to Fredericksburg every, at least once a month and spend a weekend up there. And so we were sort of like one big family.
Sure.
And the kids would be out playing and we'd be in playing pinochle or something like that. And we had good visiting. We'd go on fishing trips together as a family and stuff. So it's been good.
And taking one step back, because we didn't talk about this, but you were born and raised here in San Antonio. What did your family do when you were growing up, and what was it like growing up at that time during the Depression?
Well, you know, I was born in 1925, and so that was basically sort of the Depression area. And but we didn't know it because we didn't have any need for anything, because my father, he was in World War One for a short period of time.
Interesting.
But when he came back, he went to work for the post office.
Okay.
And he worked for the post office all his life.
Interesting.
So he had basically a good job.
Steady job.
Yeah. Back then, you know, a couple hundred dollars a month was a good, good job. I mean, I can remember taking him, going with my mother and delivering lunch to him and stuff. Because I think my mother met my father. She was working. She was from Victoria.
Okay.
My father was born and raised here in San Antonio. And Victoria was a little town, and all the girls wanted to leave and stuff. And she came down and was working at the post office cafe as a waitress. And so she met my father, and they got married. And so, and then I had an older brother and an older sister. There were three of us.
Okay.
And like I said, my father worked there at the post office. And then he had a side job, I don't know where, how or where he got it, but taking school census.
Yeah.
And they would pay him like 3 cents a name for every school, every name that he got. And he'd give them a district to canvas and stuff. And so he did that for a few years, and then and he decided, well, he'd get somebody to work for him and pay him a penny and a half a name.
Yeah.
And so he gets a penny and a half himself.
Smart man.
And so, yeah, and like that. And he was a good father, but like I say, being the baby of the family, my connection was more with my mother than with my father. My brother was growing up, and my father was an athlete. He played football, basketball. Football, I'll show you a picture too in a minute. And so my brother at one time started a baseball team and started a league called the Lone Star League. And they played at the city-owned parks and stuff. And my father would teach him how to throw the curve and the slow ball and did a lot of work with him, but he didn't have time for me. I was a baby of the family, so I was
your mother raised you.
And then just like they gave him music lessons. They taught him how to play the clarinet, and my sister learned how to play the piano. But when they came to me, I didn't learn any kind of lesson.
They were already exhausted
My mother, I had my mother's love more than my father's love, I guess it was. And just like my mother, parents lived outside of Victoria, and my brother would spend summers with my mother's parents over there. And then my sister would spend some time in the summer with her uncle in Victoria. When I wanted to go, they always said, "You're too little, you can't go." And so I never got anything, but I guess I got my mother's love, and I got my mother's determination for hard work, because I mean she would make a 10 cents go. So
yeah.
And when I was growing up, first thing I did was try to sell magazines, and that didn't work too well. But then I think my father had a connection where I finally got a job selling newspapers. Mm-hmm. And I sold newspapers on the corner of Fredericksburg Road and Donaldson Avenue. There was a Summers drugstore there. I did that probably for about 3 years when I was probably anywhere from
12. So you grew up in that Fredericksburg Road area?
Yeah. We lived at 1510 Cameron Street,
okay,
which was about three blocks from Five Points, if you know what Five Points
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And at that time, Five Points, the Mission's baseball diamond was right there.
I see.
And the Optimist Club had a bleacher seat where you could join this Optimist Club by just signing your name. And you can go there and watch the ball game. And that was only three or four blocks from the house. And we was only maybe another two or three blocks from Woodlawn, from San Pedro Park.
Right.
And so I spent my summers at San Pedro Park swimming and stuff like that. We'd even go roller skating on their, they had a dance area.
Yeah.
And did that. And then
go to the baseball game sometimes.
So we had summer, there was a group of us, I think five or six of us, played tennis. I remember my dad bought me this tennis racket that was sort of curved, looked like it was seconds or something, you know. But I got the best use out of it. And I did that and started growing up. And and my mother, I mean, I guess she spoiled me, I don't know. But I mean, just like as a kid, you do things that are crazy. And we were smoking cedar bark. And so one time my mother was away with my aunt, and I was in the house by myself, and I was smoking a cigarette in the dining room area, and the dadgum light went down and started a fire, and it burned a hole like that. And here comes my mother and my aunt. And I told her what happened and stuff. You know, I'd have to tell my mother the truth. And so she gave me a hug, and that was it. And another time, we were probably about 15 years old and working for a telegraph company delivering Western Union. And they had an office down on the corner of Commerce Street and Presa. And another friend of mine and I were working there. And one night for some reason, we got in a fight with a couple of other fellas, went through a plate glass window there, cut a big gash in my wrist there. Come home, wrapped my handkerchief around it, told my mother I fell off a bicycle and cut myself in a line. And she never said a word, and she just pulled out this black salve that we used to get from the druggist, and that we used for every kind of a cut. It should have been stitched, but she put it on there and put some gauze around it. Next morning, I just couldn't. I just had to tell her the truth.
Yep.
When she gave me a hug.
What an amazing woman.
And so, you know. And when I was working, selling newspapers and stuff, I'd probably save a nickel for myself. I'd give my mother the rest of the money, and she was my banker, and she kept my money. And between, probably mostly from selling papers, I earned enough money to buy a $24.95 bicycle. Mm. But my mother had saved all that money, and it probably took me about 2 years or 3 years to save it up. But she was my banker, and she was a wonderful woman.
What an amazing lady.
And like I say, we lived right in front of the San Pedro Creek.
Right.
Now it's covered over.
Right.
But it used to be sort of like a park. And we could go in there, and we'd go in there and fish for crawfish.
Sure.
And we'd sell them to people who wanted fishing and stuff, bait and stuff. And summers we'd get a haircut. My dad was shave all our head off, yeah. And we spend most of our time in San Pedro Park.
Yeah.
And we knew we'd have to be home at a certain time because we always had dinner. So we always, my mother didn't worry about us, but and occasionally we'd be fishing for crawfish and step on a broken bottle and cut my foot. Come home, my mother look at it, and she'd get out the kerosene, pour it in a basin. We'd put our foot in the kerosene oil because that was to draw the poison out.
Yeah.
Then she'd wrap it up, and we wouldn't be able to go to doing that for a while and stuff.
You'd be on the disabled list for a little while.
Yeah, but they did things for us, and we had a nice neighborhood. We had there was another family, an Italian family, who had a boy and had two boys. That one was my age, one was my brother's age, and so we always palled around together. And so we had a, and I went to school at Stephen F. Austin Elementary School, which was about 5 blocks from where we lived. And we walked to school and stuff and came home for lunch and did that. And I went to the Mark Twain Junior High School, which is on San Pedro and Wood and Mulberry. And then from there, I went to Jefferson. But I think when I turned 14, I got a job at Piggly Wiggly.
That's right.
And I had to go down and get my Social Security card. And, well, my name is William R. Lozano, but everybody, when I was growing up, called me Billy. So my Social Security card is signed Billy Lozano. And that's where I worked there, as we lived close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents moved away over to East Woodlawn and St. Mary's Street, close to Breckenridge Park. But I still would ride my bicycle to Piggly Wiggly in the morning and let the manager take off and get the change and have coffee with his buddies and come back. And then I'd catch the bus and go to school. After school, I'd catch the bus, come back to work and work there. And then I'd ride my bicycle home. And that was sort of my home, that Piggly Wiggly store, because I knew everybody there.
Sure.
When I was a checker at the time, and the time we had rationing, and so people would come in on Saturdays and do most of their shopping. It was just a small little store. And you'd have to add up the ration points first to make sure that they had enough. Then you could add up the money that they owned. And I remember I had this one lady that one of the things that Piggly Wiggly is famous for was half cents. So many of their items were 15 and a half cents.
I see.
And this Waldorf toilet paper was 4.5 cents. And so this one lady would come through, I'd add up her bill, and it was maybe $7.45. And just a minute, Billy, they always call me my first name. And she went over and got her 4.5 cent toilet paper so she wouldn't lose that half cent. But I mean, that was the Depression.
Yeah.
And I spent most of my time working, doing something
sure.
productive. I mean, I never did just sit around and not do anything, but we did have play times and things like that, but we learned to work, learned to save money. And the only one in my family that's sort of like me is my one daughter, mm-hmm. Laurie. She's a saver. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are spenders.
Right. So, well, that's this generation, the world we live in. Yeah. People spend money. That's just what they do. That's mm-hmm. that's why we have a however many $1 trillion national debt.
Yeah. I don't mean to bore you with all these little things.
No, I love this, Mr. Rosetta. This is so interesting to me. I love hearing about your military service, but I love hearing about just the rest of your life because, you know, growing up during that time, during the Great Depression, it's like you said, you and your family, thanks to your mother and the way you were raised, sounded like you had one of the most wonderful childhoods ever, but yet you were growing up during one of the most difficult times our country has ever faced. And to me, what that shows is that life is what you make of it. If you have fun with what you have and you don't worry about the next thing, focus on having fun and being a family with what you have, life can be pretty good regardless of the situation.
Yeah, well, just like, you know, we had this little small house. We had a living room that only a family would get together. We had a player piano, and my uncles would come over, and I'd be playing that player piano, pumping this thing. They'd be singing these songs and stuff. And that was their entertainment. It was good. And this uncle, this is the lawyer uncle, bought a place out on North Loop Road, close to the airport, and he called it his little ranchito, and he built a little place. And we'd go out there once a month, and the whole family.
Yeah.
We'd bring food, stuff, have fun, sing, pitch horseshoes, stuff like that. I mean, it was always a family type thing. I mean, I did have a drinking uncle.
Sure.
And he was a...
Everybody has one of those.
He was a character, but he was very good. He was the oldest boy in the family.
Yeah.
And he worked as a telegrapher in the railroad company. And when Pancho Villa started his war down in Mexico, my uncle went down and joined Pancho Villa and worked as his transportation person, running his trains and stuff like that.
Wow.
And he got acquainted with a number of the other politicians there. Mm-hmm. When they came back here to San Antonio, they set him up in a business of a tile company, Mosaic Tile mm-hmm. Company,
mm-hmm.
and where they had... They'd bake these tiles individually, and they were sort of a dry press. It was a German dry press. They would put certain combination of cement and stuff like that, and put pressure on it, and it stick together. They would put some paint on it that would go down about a quarter of an inch so that as it wore out, it wouldn't go. And that same tile has put in the courthouse floor mm-hmm. and at the Taj Mahal
and
Randolph Field. And there's a lot of other places here in town. But he was my drinking uncle.
Yeah.
He had a yellow cab driver that would pick him up in the morning, take him to work. And he knew about 3 o'clock that he probably had 3 or 4 drinks and he needed his cab ride home, and he'd come home.
Yeah.
But he was a colorful person, but his marriage broke up because of the drinking.
Right.
And he was real fine.
It sounds like he had a wonderful family and a wonderful upbringing.
And then, like in Victoria, my mother's folks over there, we'd go down Highway 87 to visit them because they lived out on a little farm. And we'd go there maybe once a month or once mm-hmm. every 6 weeks. And we liked to go there because it was so different. Mm-hmm. And they would, for Christmas, they wouldn't send us presents or anything. They'd send us a care package. And in that back package there, they would have some good old-fashioned bacon. That's nothing like the bacon you see with the strips.
The real stuff.
And a little, usually a ham in there.
Yeah.
And some head cheese.
Yeah.
And I forgot what else, but we were so happy when we got that. We got sausage and stuff like that. And it was real good. But you talk about the Depression, and one thing that stuck in my mind was that my mother sent me to the butcher shop one time to get 10 cents worth of boiled ham. I think I got 2 slices.
Wow.
But, I look at it now, 10 cents, you can't even smell it.
Yeah.
But, that's what we'd do. And then every Christmas, my mother, who was German, my father was Mexican and Spanish.
Okay.
His mother came from the Canary Islands.
Okay.
And my grandfather, or his father, came from Mexico.
I see.
And so that's why I say I'm half quarter Mexican, quarter Spanish, and half German.
German. I see.
And my grandfather was a nice person. I didn't get to know him real well, but what little I learned about him is that in his early years, he was an organizer. He had a paper here called El Sol that was a little Spanish newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And he organized the first, what they call mutual aid society here. And this was sort of like the beginning of the insurance company. Because
mm-hmm.
every time somebody in this society would die, everybody would have to pay a dollar in, and they'd pay for the funeral.
Interesting.
And so he established that. But when he died, before he died, he was a fruit and vegetable peddler. He had a wagon with a horse, and they lived just south of the arsenal downtown.
Yeah.
And on the street, and he had his horse and buggy in the back, and I remember that part of it. And I say, he never complained about anything. And I remember my dad would go over and play chess with him once in a while, and that he eventually had to have his leg amputated. Mm-hmm. And so I knew he had, after I grew up, I knew that he had to have diabetes or something. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, yeah.
But my grandfather came from Mexico, my grandmother from Spain,
right,
the Canary Islands, and they raised a family. And I have a book out of the Bible that they had. They had 4 children that all died at the same time. And I just get whispers from my aunts or something that there was sort of an epidemic like
the virus here
that killed all of those, and that was her first family.
Wow.
And then after that, they raised another family, and there were 3 boys and 3 girls. There were 6. And so,
what advice would you have for the young folks that are you grew up during you probably didn't even know the Great Depression was happening, right? I mean, you didn't know any different.
No, we always had
had what you needed, and you had a happy. What advice would you give to kids that are growing up these days, or maybe young folks that are going in the military, young men, you know, after you've been through all you've been through in your life and experienced everything, what would you pass on to those youngsters today?
I don't know. I do know one thing I've tried to pass on to my children and my grandchildren is to learn how to save.
That's great.
And I think that's one of the most important things that you can do, because by saving, you can accumulate funds to do things that you want to do. And also, don't be afraid to go into debt, because by going into debt, it creates an obligation that you have to carry out.
Right.
And by doing that, it allows you to obtain things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to obtain on your own.
Right.
And that was one of the words of advice my father said. He says, Billy, says, you have to establish your credit. So he says, you need a suit. So you go down here to Todd's, mm-hmm. and you open up an account, mm-hmm. and you pay him $5, and you pay him so much a month, and you do that. And when you get ready to buy a car, you got to be able to finance it,
mm-hmm.
because you have good credit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing that I would establish with a saving is to establish a good credit reputation.
Right.
And it's a reputation that you have to establish. I mean, you have to learn to do things for people.
Right.
I mean, just like when I quit practicing law, if I could collect all the money that people owed me, I wouldn't have to work for 5 years. Because there are so many people come in. I mean, I'd get divorces, and back then we'd get them for $50. But they come in and pay me $25 plus the filing fee. And they said, come in, I need to get this divorce. And I said, well, you still owe me $25. I said, well, I'll pay you later. So I get them divorced.
Never see them again. Yeah.
And I make up my mind, I'm not going to do that. And then somebody else comes up with a sad story, they do that. Or somebody comes up, I had people come up that wanted to adopt their grandchildren. But I said, you've got to help people.
Right.
And if you help people, they're going to help you.
Right.
And when you help someone, it's going to make you feel good.
Right.
And it's just not one thing. It's just
well, and you look at your life and all those times you helped people and maybe they didn't pay you, but then, you know, when you gave that example of the dean of the law school, when he referred that case to you and that ended up, you know, earning you that deal, which ended up allowing you to buy the place at Lake LBJ, which then helped to fund your retirement, you know, and everything. When you do the right thing, my experience is when you do the right thing, usually it comes back around in some form or fashion.
I just think that, you know, everybody that I knew that grew up that were in the Navy with me, they were all doing the right thing.
Right.
I mean, they grew up, they had families and stuff.
Right.
I mean, that's like when I went to law school. Most of the people there were service people.
Right.
And we didn't talk about flying. I mean, I had one fellow there, Johnson, always wore his old aircraft cap, and
yeah.
He was a captain and a pilot and stuff like that. He never bragged about it,
right,
or anything like that. And but we just all had sort of fellowship together.
Yeah, that's. I admire the life that you live, not just your military service, but just the life that you lived. It's amazing. And clearly what you've now passed down to your kids, and you can see it in your marriage, and you know how long it was you've done it all.
Yeah,
around.
I'd say they just don't make them in like that anymore.
Right.
And that concludes episode 26B, part two of our two-part interview series of Mr. Bill Lozano, United States Navy, USS Washington. Thank you so much, Mr. Lozano, for telling your amazing story with your amazing perspective from the crow's nest on top of the USS Washington. Very few, as I mentioned in the intro, very few people have a perspective on any part of World War II like Mr. Lozano, because it's just, again, it's such a vast, massive war, and people that were involved in it from any level usually were just very focused on their specific job, and so they weren't able to see sort of the larger battlefield picture. And so to have this perspective from the crow's nest on that ship is simply amazing. So thank you, Mr. Lozano, for sharing your stories. Thank you to all of our listeners for listening to the stories from these amazing men and women. I really just want to encourage all of us to share these stories with as many people as possible. If you haven't already, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your podcast. All those reviews help push this thing up in the search rankings, and then more people listen to it, which is the entire point. So appreciate all of your correspondence, the Facebook messages and emails. If you'd like to send us a note, my email address or our email address is walkamongheroes@gmail.com. I promise I'll read it and I'll respond to all of them. I've really enjoyed hearing various perspectives on Afghanistan. I so appreciate reaching out, all of you reaching out, sending World War II veterans that you think would be good to talk to. Next week, we're going to hear from an amazing veteran of World War II, kind of the tail end of World War II, and Rob, who's one of our listeners, and then his parents, Barb and Denny, reached out, and I went over to Iowa and visited with them and just had an amazing visit. And so you're going to hear about that in our next episode, about how that whole story played out. So we just so appreciate, because there's very few of these incredible folks left, and most of them lead very unassuming lives. They live by themselves, or they live in a nursing home or a senior home. And it's just, unless you know, you happen to know about them, it's difficult to find them. So thank you so much. And again, I value all of your feedback always. If you like to check out our website, the website's www.walkamongheroes.org, Facebook page, www.facebook.com/walkamongheroes, Instagram, @walkamongheroes. And then we're on YouTube and other things. There's some video interviews that are posted on YouTube and online that are sort of unedited interviews. If you'd like to actually see the veterans that we're talking to, it's an amazing way to do so. So check those out if you like, and share them, and let me know your feedback, comments, and just really enjoy hearing from all of you. As always, we want to thank all of those who protect our way of life and allow us to live the way that we live here in this amazing country. So we want to thank our police, our firefighters. We certainly want to thank our military and all that you do for us on a regular basis. We support an organization called Wish for Our Heroes. That's www.wishforourheroes.org. If you'd like to take a look at them online, it's a volunteer organization that assists military families with basic needs: food, shelter, transportation, child needs, medical expenses. We believe in the mission. We believe in helping our military families, especially during times like this. So if you haven't already, be sure to check them out. Thank you so much to our Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, Space Force, Coast Guard, all those who are stationed around the world protecting our way of life on a regular basis. Until next time, I want to encourage everybody to take a walk among heroes, reach out, talk to those who need it, reach out, lend a helping hand, and most of all, say thank you. And obviously, a huge thank you to all of those who protect our way of life and allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.